Greetings and welcome to Let's Talk About Books, baby, where we talk with your favorite LGBTQ plus authors. I'm Anita Kelly, and my guest today is Katrina Carrasco. Hi, Katrina.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Hey, thanks for being here. It's really nice to meet you. So you are a new author to me, which is really nice to see.
Oh, good. Well, I really appreciate that I've made it onto the show because I am a queer author and I always write for queer folks first. And it's nice to get to speak to your listeners and introduce myself to you. So,
oh, wonderful. Wonderful. So, well, let's just jump right in and talk about what's happening in your world. So you have a novel coming out. Or maybe it came out. It's your sophomore novel called Rough Trade,
yes.
Right?
I do. It comes out April 9th.
All right. So that's very soon.
It is.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, let's talk about Rough Trade. Tell us about, I first want to talk about Jack Camp, who is the protagonist, right? And and let's talk about the community where Jack lives and works, and let's talk about the also the title Rough Trade. So what can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so the book is set in the 1880s in Tacoma in what was Washington Territory. And the main character goes by the name Jack Camp kind of to the outside world, but the reader knows her as Alma Rosales. She's a person who's living kind of as a man in this life as a dock worker. And there's many layers of different presentations to the character. Jack, you know, is living as a dock worker and a stevedore boss, but he's actually an opium smuggler and is using the dock work to kind of cover that up. And then, of course, Jack is also Alma. Her crew, save for one of her guys, doesn't know that her name is Alma and that she's presenting as Jack. So I did want to kind of get into the space of what gender experimentation and performance were happening for this character. I don't go so far as to identify her as trans, but if readers, you know, see the character a certain way, that's completely like something I love to see. I love when people interpret things in books and kind of bring their own knowledge and make their own story. I just don't give a firm opinion on Alma's gender because I don't really know. I don't know if I could say that for them. Mm-hmm. So that's what's happening in Alma's world and in Jack's world. And let's see, what was the second part of that? Oh, the title. Title is an old kind of queer slang for picking up a working class, like a middle class man picking up a working class man for sex. And there's another main character in the book who is a queer man who kind of does that, although it complicates things in the story and in his story. And I think it's a very interesting path for him to be taking. Anyway, I wanted to kind of bring that sense of grittiness to the book. And there's also a bit of wordplay, you know, Alma's involved in the opium trade. There's a lot of talk about that and how it's sort of a dangerous industry. So it's a bit of a soft pun. I don't know if I would call it a pun, but it's certainly nodding to sort of the queer underground, queerness across class levels in an environment, and a bit to just the dangerous nature of the industry that Alma is involved in.
Wow. So let's unwrap this a little bit. So
sure.
Jack has a lot going on. Right?
Yeah.
Jack, and I appreciate that you do not tell the reader how to interpret Jack.
Right.
And that I appreciate that you leave that up to the reader. That's great. And I think probably readers appreciate that also. So Jack, or Alma, is working and living on the docks, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack's crew doesn't really know Jack. Is there anyone who knows Jack in the biblical sense?
So there's one man on the crew who Alma has confided with. I'm going to just call the character Alma because that's how I think of her.
Okay.
One of her crewmates kind of first took her to a queer bar and kind of softly came out to her. And so she sort of softly came out to him, and they're both Latino. They both speak Spanish. And I think that extra sort of sense of community or family or closeness kind of helped her feel safe enough to tell this one man that she works with, that, you know, what's under her clothes is not what he might expect. And he, being a queer person himself, sort of like, yeah, I've met people like that. So it's a very, it's like an easy moment for them and an important one, I think, to show that it happened probably in queer community, and just a moment of acceptance. And so from there, there's sort of this quiet knowledge that she can kind of rely on with this one friend member of her crew who's a friend. She also is lovers with one of the women in the town who is also involved in the opium trade. And they have sort of a long-term fling going on. And I think their dynamics are very interesting as well. And then, of course, more happens because that's all just in the setup. And an old friend of Alma's comes to town who knew her when she was a girl and was presenting as a woman. And they have kind of an unresolved attraction that takes shape throughout the course of the book. So I think there's a lot mm-hmm. of avenues yeah. of exploring gender and pleasure and how that's expressed that I think make the character, to me, like a very interesting person.
Yeah, definitely. And how did Alma become involved in the opium trade? Like where did she come from? How did she get to Tacoma? And how did she get hooked up with that?
This book is kind of a follow-on of my first book. It is definitely something you can read on its own. So it's being kind of positioned as a standalone. But the first book has a lot more to do. It's a close third on Alma, and it's a bit more about sort of where she came from and how she got involved in the trade. I would love if readers picked up both. You don't have to read them in a certain order. There are some things that will probably surprise you if you read the second book first and then you read the first book.
Okay.
But there's a lot more in that one kind of about how Alma became involved in this business. But I wanted to do something very different with the second book. Like I said, the first was a very close third person, really following her, and takes place over a short amount of time. And with this book, I really wanted to widen the lens on the time period and on queer community specifically. So I did a lot of research about queer communities at the time, kind of piecing together what I could find, and also introduced a second main character, the queer man that I mentioned earlier. So the second book in many ways has a very different focus, but certainly if you really like Alma or, you know, are just very curious about her, there is a very different lens provided by the first book, The Best Bad Things.
Okay. So that was your debut novel, right? The Best Bad Things?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that actually received several awards and really garnered such like a positive reception from the community. And so I'm wondering how that felt like coming out of the starting gate, you know, to really, you know, have the community embrace your debut novel.
Yeah, I love that book. It was the first one that I was able to sell. I think like many writers, I'd finished a few and they'll forever remain shelved because they were my training wheels efforts. But no, it was really, it was wonderful to have it come out. It did win an award for the best first PI novel. So it was sort of playing with genre. It was literary, but it had some detective elements and historical fiction. So that was recognized with that award. And it was a finalist for Lambda Literary for bisexual fiction, which I really was happy about to have it get that queer nod. And it was a finalist for the Washington State Book Award. So a lot of different places recognized it for kind of different facets, which I appreciated because it did, it does have a lot going on. And my editor loved it, and she really encouraged me to write a second book. And I'm a little stubborn, so I did it my own way, which is how Rough Trade came about. So it's still picking up a lot of the characters and the threads from the first. I tell people those that survived the first book made it into the second, usually. But it's doing it, like I said, with a very different lens and scope, and in a way that allowed me to get very into my deep curiosity and love for queer history. So it sort of set the stage for me to be able to explore this new facet of the world I'd entered with the first one.
Yeah. So it sounds like it had a pretty tremendous impact on your writing, in that it kind of gave you the green light to explore more of queer writing.
Yeah, I think it's always, you know, a lonely and frightening process sometimes to be a writer. You do most of your work by yourself. And when there are signs of encouragement, they can be very few and far between. So certainly, you know, having good critical reception and getting some very glowing reviews was encouraging. And I was fortunate enough to have some writing residencies that I did in between the books to work on the new one. I think in general, publishing can be kind of a tough business, but it never hurts to have a kind reception for one of your books.
Amen.
it was very nice to get those nods.
Well, that's nice. That's great. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
What I've not read Rough Trade, but what I've read about Rough Trade, says it could be considered like a literary coastal Western. And so in thinking about that, like I'm more of a traditionalist. Would you consider this, would this be considered like a more of a historical fiction piece?
I'm kind of firmly placing it in literary fiction because it's very character focused.
Okay.
To me, the setting is important, especially when I'm exploring queer spaces. But it's not really like a setting first book. Not to say that historical fiction always is, but I think when I think about this question, I think about like who it might appeal to. And I certainly hope it's appealing to queer readers and to people that are interested in queer history, specifically in places where we don't have a lot of representation or documentation, like the Pacific Northwest in the 1880s. Mm-hmm.
It has something you don't read about every day.
Yeah. And I felt like that with Best Bad Things, too. I didn't see a lot of stuff set in this time period. And Best Bad Things takes place in Port Townsend, which is also in the Pacific Northwest, just about a year before Rough Trade. So just really trying to explore a facet of the area that I hadn't seen and was curious about myself. So I think, you know, some people thought that Best Bad Things was a Western. And again, like, I love when readers have their own interpretation. That's the special thing about reading to me, is that everyone brings their own experiences to every book and has a very personal experience with it, which I think is just magic. Mm-hmm. And I certainly play with a lot of genre tropes in both books. But I think when I envision them, I think they're really about character first. And for that reason, I think rather than any of the genre slots, I would place them in literary. So,
okay, that makes sense to me. So, what kind of research did you have to do for Rough Trade? And you know, was it, I can't imagine, you know, that there is much out there about, you know, the gay world in 1880 in Tacoma, Washington.
Right. So I love doing research. I did a ton for the first book and sort of got my sense of place with the materials I could find for this area. I live in Seattle, so it's fairly local for me.
Okay.
And in terms of trying to sort of faithfully reimagine or reconstruct a queer space, I looked at what research and documentation was available both for the time period. So that might be from other bigger places where there were actually queer communities that left some documentation or a mark. One example is in Brooklyn. There's a wonderful writer, Hugh Ryan, who one of his books is called When Brooklyn Was Queer. And it goes into a long history of Brooklyn, but it includes the 1880s. So cross-referencing stuff like that, like New York, London, what was sort of happening in queer spaces at those times, what kind of language were people using, who was gathering there. And then in addition to that, I was looking at how was homosexuality in particular being treated in the Pacific Northwest specifically. A really great resource I found, I think, is called Homosexuality in the Pacific Northwest. And it's a study by a scholar who I think teaches in Idaho. He's a queer man. And that was very interesting because we don't have a lot of records. Often if it was a working class person, they might not have left any kind of written record of their own in this time period. Mm-hmm. But what this scholar did find was a lot of arrest records. So it's that sense of sort of a community defined by its edges where they sort of bump up against the law. Of course, like it was illegal to be caught with a same-sex partner. Here in the States, it was usually not a something that was strongly punished, but that wasn't always the case. It depending on men's class, because this is mostly men being discovered. If they were working class or drifters, they would be imprisoned. They might be chemically castrated. So there were certainly strong consequences and dangerous consequences to being a queer person that was engaging with law enforcement. So
I wouldn't think that patterns at the time. So that's cool.
But yeah, it was definitely a very male environment in the Pacific Northwest too.
I'll bet.
Yeah, like lumber towns and stuff. There was a lot of what were called homosocial spaces where it was only men, and men were kind of fulfilling all roles, including sexually. And it wasn't really a thing, but of course, there's the whole history of queerness and how it can coincide with being seen as not performing something adequately socially or being like socially unacceptable. And that's where usually law enforcement would come in. So just a lot of very interesting stuff. I could talk about this for an hour, so I'll stop. But
no, this is really interesting. And, yeah. And I'm amazed that you found so much information.
Yeah, it was important to me to try and reconstruct a queer community that was based in what little we do know. But something I just want to note kind of on the tail of all that is it was really important to me to not depict a queer community that was experiencing persecution or violence. I feel like we see that all the time in media representations of queer communities, especially historical queer communities. And I very intentionally chose to not have the bar where the men gather get raided. I didn't want to show anybody getting arrested. Like, mm-hmm. all of that was part of my research process, mm-hmm. but it's very intentionally kept out of the book because I wanted to have a depiction of queer communities that were actually just a source of community and a place where people would meet and be friends and have lovers and be able to sort of feel freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to bring any of that, the violence or the trauma into the story because, you know, I think we're all aware that it was there. And I just really wanted to have this be more of a positive depiction of this kind of community in the past.
Yeah. And I appreciate that because, you know, for a lot of readers, you know, it's a form of escape and the world in which we live in right now is, you know, full of, you know, persecution and yes. violence against the LGBTQ plus community. So, you know, for me, I know, like, I could do without that in a book I'm reading, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's great. So, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Is there a third one on the way? Do you have a work in process?
I do have a work in progress, but it's going to be a shift in a totally different direction. It's a contemporary novel. I never thought I would end up writing things that were historically set, so that was kind of an adventure for me with the first two. But yeah, it's kind of a brand new thing that I've been starting, and it feels really good and really interesting, but it's not going to have anything to do with the first two books. Other than that, it's me writing it, and I think the same kind of things will obsess me for over and over again as a writer. So I'm interested to see how that takes shape in this new one.
And will it be set on the West Coast, like the north in the Northwest, or?
It'll probably be set in California. That's where I'm from. So I wanted to do something closer to home and kind of get more into my geographic knowledge, because I've lived in the Pacific Northwest now for about 15 years, but I'm Californian and I lived there for most of my early life. So it's definitely kind of a brand new clean slate. It's still going to be very gay because my books will always be very gay.
That's
But
good.
yes.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. So, just a random question. What part of California are you from?
I'm from Orange County, and I grew up there in the 90s when it was really conservative. So it was definitely, I think it's changed a lot in recent years. But it was a strange place to grow up as sort of like a figuring out that I was queer kid. I feel like I didn't figure it out very quickly just because I was kind of raised in a sheltered area, where no one really talked about things like that. We didn't have the internet till I was in high school. So
Really?
yeah,
Did
I'm
you
in the
grow up in
early
like a
30s,
conservative
so
environment?
not particularly, but I think I didn't have access to a lot of things that I feel very glad that younger people and everyone have access to now, in terms of just the way that the internet has allowed us to see so many more perspectives. And of course, there's great downfalls to everything that have to do with the internet and social media and whatnot, but it's a big window that wasn't there when I was a kid. And I don't even think I understood what queerness was until I was a teenager, because I just was never told about it. And I think I started to understand from books, but I feel like I was a very late bloomer in certain ways, and I think partly, where I grew up wasn't accelerating that at all.
Yeah, it's not something that people just kind of randomly start talking about. Well, so growing up in Orange County, did you ride horses? Do you ride horses?
No, I don't really have any horse connection. I did work at a stable one summer, but I think my mom just wanted me to do something productive with my time. But I love animals. I have dogs and I love them. But no, horses are beautiful and also very tall, and I'm kind of scared to be that high off the
That they are. It's
ground.
yes. Oftentimes I find that women in particular who write stories that, are written in back in this era, like have a connection to horses. So that's why I ask.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, kind of like I said, that the setting for both books, because the second one's kind of dependent off the first, it came more from wanting to have a setting that made gender very conspicuous, but also very like rigidly accepted. And what I mean by that is, and there's kind of more about this again in the first book, but when Alma is passing as Jack, or living as Jack, however the reader would like to envision that, given the time period, very few people would question someone wearing men's clothes as to, are you a guy? Are you a man? And vice versa. And there was also so much more rigidity between what men's clothes were versus what women's clothes were. There wasn't like a androgynous style that would have been acceptable yet. Mm-hmm. I think that was coming in the late 1800s with stuff like the bicycle and pantaloons or pantalettes or whatever the early sort of acceptable pants that women could wear were. Mm-hmm. But I was very interested in how that sort of hard expectation led to blindness on the part of casual observers who just sort of assumed gender. Yeah. And that was one of the big reasons that I chose to set it in the 1880s. But it was very interesting to research otherwise. And I learned a lot of information about the area that I found just, you know, I kept opening new pages and getting new books to read and all that like lovely wormhole mm-hmm. process when you're researching something and find new things of interest.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wasn't led there by horses so much as by my own kind of gender presentation confusion, which I really experienced when I first came out. I came out sort of later in life in my early 30s and went through a period of trying to be butch and realizing that wasn't going to work and figuring out what that meant for myself and what clothes meant for me. And I think I became very deeply interested in that question as part of my own kind of processing and figuring out.
Self-exploration. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, in keeping with that time, like the Civil War was maybe 20 years before that. And, you know, there was during that time, there was a lot of like cross dressing going on. People, mm-hmm. you know, women were dressing as men, presenting as men so that they could engage in the war. Mm-hmm. You know, I never read a lot about men presenting as women during that time. But yeah, a lot of women did just so, you know, they could fight or be part of, you know, be part of something bigger than themselves.
Yeah, I did find, I wish I had a list of all of my books because I have some very interesting resources I've amassed. But there's a few that have documentation of, I think, what today we would interpret as trans women. And for the most part, people just left everyone alone. Like, I think it there was not really the pathology attached to queerness that kind of came into play in the early 1900s, mm-hmm. Kind of until the end of the 1800s. And then there was a lot of stigma that formed and, you know, the medical community weighing in and sort of snowballing through history. But there was a period where I think, you know, people sort of dressed and presented as they felt, and it wasn't something that was necessarily remarked upon. Not to say that there was some sort of, you know, golden age happening mid 1800s, but I do think that might have been a lot more gender variance than we're aware of because it wasn't recorded necessarily or a problem for people.
So. Yeah, I agree. I think people were just trying to survive, and they were like, you know, kind of the motto of the day was live and let live. You know, and so, you know, I think there probably was a lot more that we're aware of at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Which is kind of reassuring to know as a queer person, right? Like that to me is a big point of this new book for me for Rough Trade is it's so harmful to feel like you don't have anything to relate to, whether that's right now or in the people that came before you. And I do find the project of trying to reestablish, if we can, a better sense of queer history that, again, isn't just so rooted in trauma. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what I like to read, I like to see, and I hope my books help kind of fill that niche, because representation is crucial and it doesn't just need to happen now. I think that the sense that, oh, like people like me have always been around is something very reassuring and also a message that a lot of queer people don't get very often. So,
yeah. Yeah. Like I didn't invent this, you know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I do hope that is something this book kind of offers to people.
Yeah. That's great. It sounds like it will. So I have to ask you, Katrina, if you could be born into any historical time, like what era would just like really suit you? Where would you see yourself just really fitting in?
Oh my gosh.
Could be past, present, future, you know?
Yeah, you know, I feel in some ways grateful to be alive right now. Obviously, we're not living in the coolest timeline at the moment, but for many reasons. But I was born with like a congenital issue, and medical science kept me alive. So I feel like that, you know, I couldn't have been born in the 1700s because I just would have been not making it. So I do feel like now's the goodest time as ever for that. And I do love that I live in a time and a place where I was able to do something like come out to friends and family and explore my gender presentation. And that is certainly not a privilege that many people have to do so with like safety and love and support. And I think I'm kind of right where I'd like to be. So
awesome. Awesome. I like that. That kind of leaves me with a sense of contentment, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Like there's work to be done, but we're here to do it. We're going to do it. So,
yeah. Nice. Wonderful. So, how can our listeners contact you? I know some of our listeners like to contact our authors and, maybe send some emails or chat. How can they do that? How can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, I have a pretty light presence on social media and the internet, mostly for my own mental health. I think it's a tough place to be in some ways. So I do have an Instagram. It's kind of my only thing I do. And I mostly just post pictures of me and my girlfriend and my dog, but it's nice. I don't know. I will have book stuff up there as things get closer and I start getting like reviews to share. Something fun that I'm going to do that I don't know if anyone would be interested among your listeners, but I am going to do a little giveaway closer to the release date. And I have some old hard copies of my first book, hardback. And I'm going to get hardback author copies of my new one. And I'm going to do a little signed set of one or two of those for someone that's interested in getting both and having them signed. So that's something cute that I was just like, they're going to look so pretty together. And the hardbacks are no longer available. So that'll be on my Instagram.
That is fun. That is great. Yeah.
I like it. And I have a website with kind of a contact me feature.
Okay.
And that goes to an email inbox. So it's always nice to chat with readers. I've received some really lovely letters from readers that have really made my day. So I do think it makes a huge difference if you tell someone that you enjoyed their book, just because, as I said earlier, usually publishing and writing is just a whole lot of not great news most of the time. And any kind of even a little note like I really, you know, enjoyed this is always very happily received. And that's not just for me. I think most writers would say that. So
yeah, definitely.
Happy to chat either of those mediums.
What is your IG account? Just Katrina Carrasco?
I am looking right now. I should know this. Yes, it's _K_Carrasco.
Okay.
Just Carrasco. I think my name was taken or something when I tried to make it. So
okay. That's wild. I wouldn't think that. Yeah.
I didn't really jump on the bandwagon fast enough with that one. So and then my website's just my name. It's KatrinaCarrasco.com.
Okay. All right. Awesome. So listeners, this is how you can get in touch with Katrina. And sometime soon before April 9th, her second book, Rough Trade, will be coming out. And you will have an opportunity for a fun giveaway of a hardback signed copy and a hardback copy of the first book, The Best Bad Things.
Yeah. So
that's exciting. All right. Well, Katrina, do you have any parting words for our listeners today?
I didn't think of that in advance. I mean, I'm always on the lookout for more wonderful queer stories. So certainly if you want to get in touch and say hi and let me know a book that really mattered to you, that you felt kind of really fed your heart, you know, as a queer person, I'd love to hear that, because I do tend to look for queer stories first, and it's nice when they have that bit of, you know, sense of community or sense of sort of nourishing your soul a little bit. So I would love those recommendations. Otherwise, I hope you enjoy reading the books. I'm going to do a couple small events for releases in the Seattle area and in Los Angeles. Just a small little reading tour this time, but I'd be happy to say hi to anyone in those areas too. So nice. That'll be on my Instagram as well when I actually have my dates figured out.
Nice. That'd be great. Listeners, I hope you get to meet Katrina and get out and enjoy some of those venues too. Great. Well, that is all the time we have for today. And I'm Anita Kelly. Thanks for joining Liz Talk About Books, Baby. And a big thank you to Karina Carrasco for joining us today.
Thank you, Anita.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Until next time, may your journey be lighthearted, peace be plenty, and be safe, folks.